Hey guys, welcome back to another week of Autastic, your comedian's guide to autism. I'm one of your hosts, Kirk Smith, and here as always, my co-host,
Graham K. Hey everybody.
We have a great, we have an exciting news for this this episode. Graham, you wanna talk about it a little
bit? Yes. As promised, last episode, we've been saying it for maybe over a year. We've been saying we were going to do it. And last episode, I made a promise to you, our loyal listeners, that we would finally have my mother as a guest on. And I know her. I know I got somebody on the inside, and I was able to score an interview with my mother. And
you got good contacts.
I got good contacts. Phoned my press agent or my publicist, and yeah, we got her. And yeah, it's just good to talk to her. I talk to her a lot, but you know, I don't really ever talk to her about this subject. So it was nice to. It was interesting.
Yeah, I think it's.
Full
disclosure, we. Yeah.
And hopefully you got.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, yeah. Full disclosure, we did the interview, and it's very interesting. Like the stuff she wants to. I think we should talk about it, but I cut you off. Go ahead.
No, I just hope that you, the listeners, find it helpful. You know, cause just because she has an adult son and has been through it all, and I think you will hear it in her voice. She is still the battle is not over, but she is still optimistic and is having a good life and loves her son. So
let's hear it.
Yeah, let's do it. Here's my mom. Okay, so at long last, after a lot of listeners' requests, I finally stopped being lazy, and we're having sort of a minor celebrity on this show, because you have a lot of fans, Mom. My mother is on the line. We're interviewing my mother right now, Constance Hudak. Mom, how are you?
I am wonderful and glad to know I'm a celebrity.
You're known as Peter's mom.
Peter's mom. People love Peter's mom. I tell a lot of stories, and you know, and we just thought it would be good to have you on. Because a lot of our listeners are parents who are going through and about to go through. What you've already been through, because my brother, your son Peter, is 33, and also I think you have done a fantastic job of being strong and not giving up and pushing and just being a good parent. But that's all I'm going to say about that. I'm going to let Kirk do most of the interview because. Both of you are parents, and you know, you have probably more insight on that, Kirk, than I do. So we'll just, Kirk, take it away.
Oh, thank you so much for agreeing to do our show. Peter's mom, we're excited to have you.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad that Graham still knows how to suck up to a mom after all these years.
Oh, I'm getting it in there.
Well, he's doing it when it counts.
Yeah.
He's doing it when it counts. I'm sure you'll get the insults when we stop recording. Hey, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are kind of in the early stages, I would say. You know, their kids are, you know, a lot of families at 3 to 12, 15. What would you say if you now have the experience of the ability to look back, and what advice would you give yourself if you had to do this whole thing over again?
Just don't underestimate the potential for your child. I mean, every case is different, but when you think that, gee, this is it never is, because they'll surprise you in showing you how much more they can do each time. So challenge them, challenge the system, and just be consistent. Don't give up. That's what my husband and I did. We just never gave up.
And when you say challenge the system, Mom, what do you mean about challenge the system? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, when you think that, okay, what resources are out there? Can I find something? Keep looking. In terms of the schools, we were in a situation where there was a spare amount of special education for Peter, and we pushed for it, and we kept calling, and it took a while, but we got him placed in a special ed class, and that really worked for him. We did other things. We never assumed he couldn't do certain things, because physically, he was always very, very able. So as you know, we dragged the both of you through everything, whether it was ski holidays or holidays anywhere. We just felt, well, let's find out what he can do. So we just pushed. And when I say the system, sometimes it was institutions, sometimes it was just events or activities. But we didn't try to restrict ourselves in terms of things.
That makes sense. That makes sense. So if you we have a lot of parents who, I think second guessing yourself is kind of part of the being a parent in general.
Yeah.
There's always 20/20 hindsight. So what would you tell young parents who are like, you know, the thing is every kid is so different and everybody's path is so different. So sometimes when you say, don't underestimate what they can do, then they can interpret it as, you know, second guessing, oh, if we'd done this, he might have been able to do this. Or what would you say to that kind of stuff? Does that make sense?
Oh, I know. I mean, you can always be second guessing, and did you not try something and you should have? I don't want to give people that impression. I'm just saying that you've got your child. Every child's different. They're all different on the spectrum in terms of what they can and can't do. So observe them closely and try and figure out what could be done. For the longest time, for example, people were saying, well, you have to be really careful with Peter. And we were saying, okay, but does that mean he can't go to the corner store and pick up something? Because we would have sent Graham, so why can't we send Peter?
That's a good point.
And we did, but we did it in a more controlled way. So when we said to Peter, go and buy some milk, and mercifully, we had a corner store in those days, two blocks away. And Peter had gone there many a time with us. So what I did was I took him a few times again myself, and I said, this is what's going to happen when I ask you to go and buy milk. You're going to go to this spot on the counter. You're going to pick one. You're going to take it to this man, and you're going to give him money. And what we did was we made sure that whenever we sent Peter to the store or to pick up something, that we just gave him enough money to cover it. He didn't have to worry about, did he have enough? He gave the bills that he had in his hand to the man. The man gave him some change, and Peter walked home with the milk.
I love
it. So we made it simpler.
Yeah.
But you're also teaching him some independence, too, and the ability to do something for himself.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And he would be playing with the kids on the street. And he was no more or no less reckless than any of them on the street.
Right.
He would be on his tricycle. He wanted to be part of a street fair that we had. We would watch him. We'd always watch him. But we would sometimes put some additional controls around what he did, like this business of practicing things. But you'd have to practice with him. I know that structure for him was essential. So he got really nervous when we traveled somewhere. And I remember being somewhere on a ski break for March and going into a hotel, and he was like 4.5, 5 years old. And the very first thing we did was we walked around and we said, look, here's the kitchen. This is where mommy's going to cook. See, there's a dishwasher. And I opened it up for him and it looked like our dishwasher. And I showed him the refrigerator where we would put food. And I showed him the television. And I said, do you want to sit on the couch and watch TV with Graham like you do at home? And then we'll go to bed. And so I walked him around. And it takes him a while. He processed things. Then he decided, okay, this was okay. It was close enough to what he could understand.
Remember, you called it a hotel room house.
That's and what he did. He said, I like this hotel room house.
Hotel room house. I remember that. That was really funny. The best.
let me. That's great. Let me ask you this. Like, you know how when you're, for a lot of parents, me included, like the you get the diagnosis, and we don't have any history in my family that I know of anything, any mental illness, any autism, anything. So it never even occurred to me this is a possibility. So then when it happens, there's a period of frustration and grief. And then at some point, there's an acceptance and a peace about the whole situation. Talk to me a little bit about your experiences surrounding that. When did that happen for you, and how did that work? And yeah.
Yeah. It kind of happened in stages. Like he wasn't speaking at the age of two. And mm-hmm. so my doctor, you know, the pediatrician would say, he's a second kid. He doesn't have to speak. Every time you're pouring juice for Graham, you're just automatically going to pour juice for Peter. So he doesn't have to speak. He just gets it. Well, I kind of bought that for another month or so, but then I said, no, there's got to be something. So they sent us to a speech therapy clinic. And he'd be going to the speech therapy clinic, and I'd be talking to the therapist. And she said, we're making progress. And he'd start to say a few words. And so I always thought it was something to do with speech, for example. The issue of mental capacity or autism hadn't yet hit me, or hit us, rather. And so then he started to speak, and he starts to go to four-year-old kindergarten. And he is in four-year-old kindergarten with a teacher, and she's been teaching for 35 years. This is her last year, and she was the queen of the neighborhood. Everybody knew that if you got into Mrs. So-and-so's class, you'd made it. Well, within a month, she calls us in. We figure, what's he done? And she says, here are my observations. He never wants to sit at circle time and listen to stories and be part of the story. He just automatically just listens for a moment and gets up and goes off to the back room and plays by himself with trucks over and over. And she gave all of these examples of how he would withdraw himself and be quite happy with himself doing something else. And so she said, I think there is something here. I am not a professional, but we're going to call the school board and get a board psychologist. In the interim, I don't think he's going to work in this kind of a learning environment. He has to be in a smaller group. So we said, okay, we need to get this investigated again. It was behavioral. He wasn't violent to any of the other kids or anything like that. He just didn't want to have anything to do with them. So we finally got an assessment by a board psychologist, and that's when it hit us. He said, I can't be sure, but if I look at all of the examples of behavior, I would say that it's closest to autism. And, of course, at that point, the only thing we had heard of autism were the very, very extreme cases where children and individuals are completely isolated in a world of their own and non-communicative. And that's when we started to do research, and we found that there was a spectrum and a range, and our kid likely was on it. So we knew then there were a lot of tears. You know, a lot of tears. But then he went to school, and he went into the special ed class, which was, in fact, again, for speech therapy. So these were the golden days of education where there were a maximum of 8 kids by law with 2 trained aides and a trained spec ed teacher. So 3 to 8. And that meant that they could take each kid sort of on a one-to-one basis for so many hours a day. Anyway, Peter blossomed under that. And he blossomed because he got individual attention, and it was repeat, repeat, repeat. And he learned. And so the irony of all of this is that after going through public school and going through what we call high school here in Canada, he actually spells better
than
Graham.
They do in America, too.
Yes.
Pardon me?
And yes, he spells better than you do.
He does spell better.
His sentence structure is a bit odd.
I think I'm a little dyslexic like you, Mom.
Oh, yeah, I am. I I'm terrible with numbers. I inverse numbers and things like that. And was terrible with sciences in high school and terrific with languages and history. But anyway, that's sort of our story. Throughout all of this, David would, and I would have highs and lows. We would go to parent-teacher interviews, and we would have teachers sometimes say, oh, don't worry. I remember one when he was in maybe grade six or something like that. And she said, I never thought that my, you know, I thought that my son had plateaued, and yet now he's an architect. And I kind of walked out of there saying, you know, I shouldn't give up and just assume this is it. But then I kind of said, well, I don't think Peter's going to be an architect, but he's going to be the best that he can be. And you know, we still are doing research on autism. My husband found some kind of a TED Talk on Netflix that deals with autism, and he wants me to go and listen to it. And, you know, he served on various boards for local, provincial and community associations that deal with, developmentally challenged, you know, youth and persons. So we're still involved up to our necks.
That's great.
Well, that's great.
Was there sort of like, Mom, I know I said Kirk would do all the interviewing, but I'm just curious.
Go on, buddy.
There must have been like, when you get to a point where you're like, yes, I'm not giving up on pushing forward I'm not setting any limits for him, but I know he's not going to be an architect. Just letting go must have been a relief in some level.
Well, letting go in terms of just accepting that this is it?
Acceptance, that's what I'm trying to say. Yes, yes.
Well, it wasn't a relief as such. It was just a final acknowledgement. And then you start worrying sort of on a different level because you've got a young child, and the young child is in a teenager, and so far all is good, and that person's under your wing. But then as he got into his 20s, we were saying, oh my God, you know, there's sex education, there's relationships, there's, you know, what are we going to do when we're not around? Because those still were the days where you could go to a shopping mall and you would see, an 80-year-old parent with a significantly handicapped 50-year-old, 60-year-old following them in a shopping mall, and they had not been integrated. And you say, what's going to happen to them when parent goes? And that kind of prompted us to start planning and thinking, and in fact, encouraging Peter to be even more independent and trying to assess whether he could live on his own, and so on and so forth.
Right. And you've done that.
We've done that to a point. The irony is that I don't know why, whether I've gotten a few more gray hairs or something like that, but in the past month, he's asked twice about something or other, a particular bill that we've handled. And he says, well, who's going to do that for me when you're dead? Peter's very direct.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that he's thinking about it. You know, it's funny. He said this summer, we were driving home, just him and I was driving home from the cottage back to Ottawa. And we left you guys at the cottage. And he's like, you know, Graham, what are we going to do with the cottage when they're dead? I don't know. I think we should sell. I don't like going to the cottage and you live in America. It's like, okay.
Yeah, well, you know. So he's got some ideas about things and he's independent, so.
But when I finally put you in a home, what is gonna happen? Like what do you think is gonna happen to Peter? Are you optimistic?
Yes. I mean, I'm a mother. I never stop worrying. Mm-hmm. And in theory, if you ever do put me in a home, it's because mentally I'm gone. So I won't worry and won't care at that point, right? I'll be gone.
Well,
that's a good answer.
We'll see.
But what we have been able to do, and we're fortunate, is that Peter does live alone in an apartment. And we have a very strong family. And we've tried to set it up so that there will be some income to deal with his day-to-day living expenses because, you know, the property is dealt with already. So what worries me is, will he have a job? Will he have some social interaction? Because the biggest challenge for persons on the spectrum is loneliness. We see that. And if he doesn't have an activity, or if the support group that he currently has goes away and isn't replaced by something else, that's what worries me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think, knowing our family, he would ever be alone.
Alone in the sense of
not having someone to help him. But you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well,
and you're a good, strong brother, too, so.
Yeah, I mean, I'll always be there. That's one of the reasons why I moved closer to, when I left L.A., one of the reasons is New York's a lot closer.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we set Peter up, too, because we wanted you to have a life, too. You can't have a life that is based solely on dealing with Peter.
I'm not worried about it.
I think that's good advice, too. Yeah, you can't have your life solely based on him either. I agree.
I haven't done a lot of thinking about it because you're so young and vibrant, you know, but
I love that.
Yeah. But
you won't think that when you're changing my diaper on the way to the home.
Yeah. I'll pay some crooked doctor. Nurse.
Young and Italian is my preference.
I like how your dad's Scottish and she's like, young and Italian's what I want.
She likes the swarthy men. She chose dad.
I want somebody with a little pencil mustache and a cape.
Yeah.
Well, we're
you guys have, Dad and you have done such a great job that I'm not, it's the loneliness, but in terms of being independent, I could, you know, you can take care of him via the phone in terms of any problem he has. It's only if it needs to be pointed. He's like a ship that needs to be pointed in the right direction. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, then he's pretty much self-sufficient. So it's not that big of a, and you know, I'll be rich, so it'll be fine.
And how about your hair?
Good. I want that home on the Italian Riviera then.
I'm noticing a theme about Italian men. Well, we gotta wrap up.
Yeah, Mom, I appreciate your time, and I love you very much.
And I love you too, and thank you, Kirk. And I hope this has been helpful. It's only our experience, and most of the time we're still laughing.
Ah, that's great. Yeah, very helpful.
And, you know.
Great to meet you. Thank you so much for being on our little podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, you're welcome.
Bye-bye. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
All right, well, that was it. What do you think, Graham?
That was it.
This is unusual to talk about this stuff with your mom. It's probably not something you guys talk about every time you see her.
We're not an emotional family in particular, but or we don't talk about that. But it's good to talk to her about it. I mean, there was a couple times where, you know, I sort of had to hold back some sort of emotional response, and then I could hear it in her voice a bit too. But
yeah.
You know, it's tough to go back to those tough times. And, as I'm sure you know, what did you think of it? Was it a lot? I mean, you're a parent. It rings more true to you than it does to me. How did you feel about it?
I think it's interesting. You know, I think, you know, I kind of asked about the acceptance of it and she gave kind of a more nuanced answer about basically it's in stages, right? And so the implication being that it's a continuous ongoing thing. And then she alluded to as much towards the end when she was like, the battle continues, it's different. You're thinking about different stuff. And I thought it was interesting. You know, it talks about different worries, and as a mother, I'll always worry. So I thought it was very insightful. Very insightful.
Yeah.
I thought it was good. You know, it's
yeah,
the experience of one person, but it's one person who's had to deal with this on a very real and personal level. And so I think it's always insightful for our parents. And
I know that she said that, like, it never ends, and I don't want you to feel bad or be worried about that, Kirk. You know, like, she's a happy person and she loves her son, and I don't think it ever ends for anybody. I mean, I'm a comic in New York, and I'm the one who is cognitively normal. I'm sure she worries about me a lot too. You know what I mean? Like, it's or not normal, whatever the phrase is that won't get hate mail.
Yeah,
neurotypical. Thank you.
Guys, this has been kind of an in-depth one, kind of a heavy one. Send us your messages. I'm curious. We'd love to, you know, we talked about this before. We're going to do an episode dedicated to your mail. So send us your mail. Let us know what you think, what you'd like to hear from us. And, I thought it was great to have Pete's mom on it. The great Pete's mom. So that was great.
Pete's mom! My mom, too.
Take a second to... Okay, You're a byproduct of you're a byline. Also, Graham K's mom. send us your messages. Like us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. As you know, I'm Kirk Smith Comedy. I will be in Portland this week. I might have already been in Portland by the time this airs. February 8th and through 11th. And then Vancouver is coming up. I'd love to come see you guys. Patreon.com/autastic for just $1 an episode. We love your support. It goes towards keeping this podcast on the air. And support my friend Graham. Graham, tell us about your upcoming stuff.
Oh, same old, you know, Graham K. Okay on Instagram and Twitter. And you can go to comedybythegraham.com for show listings. That's some pretty sweet pictures of me.
Ooh, I'm listening. Guys, we love it. I hope this episode reaches you guys in a good place. Hope you're doing well. We love it. You can do it. Have a great week.
Yeah, me too.